Hi, everybody. Hello. Welcome to New York University, the Department of Russian and Slavic Studies. I'm Anne Lounsbury, the chair of the department, and I'm very pleased to be able to introduce two distinguished guests today. And I'm going to use my crib sheet to read from their very, very extensive bios. First, we have our speaker, Julia Yoffe. She's a founding partner and Washington correspondent at PUC News. Previously, Yoffe was a U.S. politics, national security, and foreign policy reporter at The Atlantic. Prior to 2017, she was a contributing editor at Politico magazine, where she covered the 2016 election, as well as a contributor at Huffington Post Online and a columnist at Foreign Policy. She was a senior editor at The New Republic from 2012 to 2014 and Moscow-based correspondent for Foreign Policy and The New Yorker. Her articles have appeared in many venues, including The Washington Post, New York Times, The New Yorker, Foreign Policy, Forbes, and Bloomberg. Yaffa has appeared on MSNBC, CBS, PBS, and other news channels as a Russia expert. And I would also like to introduce Yevgenia Albats, who's our own Yevgenia Albats, research professor in the NYU Department of Russian Slavic Studies, an investigative journalist, political scientist, author, and radio host. Since getting her PhD in political science at Harvard, Albats has split her time between academia and journalism. She was a professor of political science at the Higher School of Economics, where she was also the first professor to be fired at the request of the Kremlin. She's been editor-in-chief. That's a mark of honor, right? You want that first line on your CV, right? She's been editor-in-chief of the political weekly The New Times since 2007 and was a talk show host at Echo Moskvy until the station was taken off the air 5 days after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Her show, Absolute Albats, now continues on her YouTube channel. Dr. Albats was previously distinguished journalist in residence at the Jordan Center here at NYU from 2022 to 23. She's also been a media and democracy fellow at Harvard Kennedy School and a fellow at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. She teaches political science at the Harvard Extension School and is the author of four independently researched books, including State Within a State, The KGB and Its Hold on Russia, Past, Present, and Future. Please join me in welcoming Julia Yaffa and Yevgenia Albats. I've been asked to remind you to follow us on social media. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you very much for this lovely introduction. Julia, thank you. I'm going to call you Julia because I don't understand this Julia.
Me neither.
You do, yes, so two of us. And thank you very much for agreeing to speak. And you see your books
Thank you.
here.
Thank
So
you.
we're going to have, you know, this the signing of the book after the event. We have 20 books, so you know, first students go first, and then I'm sorry, you know. But I will be left you know, you can also have it. So as Anne said, my name is Yevgenia Albats. I'm running this series of conversations under the title "Russia and Its Neighbors in Search of a New Paradigm." It is another attempt to understand what happened institutionally, politically, culturally. What happened to Russia that it's turned into this militaristic, aggressive power, which is conducting this awful war in Ukraine and killing people of Ukraine on a daily basis? 11 days ago, we conversed with a Harvard economist, Oleg Itzhoki. He was our inaugural speaker. About the sustainability of the war in Ukraine from the perspective of the Russian economy. If you missed it, you can find the record on the Jordan Center YouTube channel and the version with Russian subtitles on the New Times portal YouTube channel, Yevgenia Albats 2025. Since then, there were a couple events happened that are important. The U.S.-Russia summit was announced to be held in Budapest, Hungary, and was canceled in a matter of 2 days. Instead, President Trump announced sanctions against two of Russia's biggest oil companies, Rosneft and Lukoil. The other two Russian oil companies had sanctions imposed by President Biden. The US-based Energy Information Agency projected a 25% drop in crude oil prices. Today, the Central Bank of the Russian Federation published a statement as saying that there is a possibility that oil prices on crude Russian oil, Urals, will drop to 35 bucks per barrel. It means that Russia is unable, you know, I mean, it's already, you know, there is a huge budget deficit because Russian federal budget, more than 40% goes to the war effort and law enforcement or you know, and punitive agencies. However, you know, according to the very well-informed Russian economist, 35 bucks per barrel means that there will be the possibility of a huge financial crisis the way it happened in 1998. And these are some good news that, thanks God, we have. So,
What time horizon did he give?
by the end of by the beginning of January 2026.
Oh.
Yeah, it can be very quickly. Because you know there is oversupply of oil now on the market due to you know Brazil, United States, and it's also you know about that Venezuela will come out on the market. So and of course you know there has been an agreement with Saudi, and that you know they also will increase their output. So now there is oversupply of oil. It's nice because it means that oil prices, you know, gasoline prices will go down in this country. So your politicians no longer concerned about that, as Biden was anyway. And for Russian economy, that was the main source of income for its war economy, and you know for producing of all these awful missiles for the Western side. So, but you know, let's go to your book. I read it in full.
Oh my
It's
goodness.
very, very, yeah, I'm serious. You know, I finished reading it last night, late at night, and I really enjoyed it. It's extremely interesting reading. It's made me so nostalgic because basically you have been writing about, you're writing about my life. And I also, you know, I felt very grateful to you for writing about these everyday lives of Soviet and Russian women, a topic known very little outside Russia. I gather that that a lot of people were interested in Russian politics, and especially, you know, in Putin's lovers, you know, Kabaeva, you know, Kalagriva and others, and you know, all his bastards and etc. But however, few foreign observers know what it's like to be a woman in Russia. Why do Putin's mistresses, as mistresses of the high-placed bureaucrats, give birth in Switzerland rather than in Moscow, despite all the wealth and power their men have? And why have freedom of choice and reproductive rights never been issues in the USSR? In contrast, an abortion was a form of contraception in the country that was the first to send a man to space. So my first question to you, why so few Western academics and journalists, and I would recall Sherwood Fitzpatrick's book, Everyday Stalinism, Hendrik Smith, Russians, the CNN's former Moscow bureau chief, Jill Doherty, with her latest book, her memoir on being an exchange student in Leningrad, in the late 1990s, amazing account, absolutely amazing account of Leningrad in the late 1960s and 70s, and now your book. So tell me, why there was so little interest in the subject?
So first of all, I will answer in a second, but first of all, thank you so much to NYU and the Jordan Center for having me, and thank you so much to Evgenia Markovna. And the fact that you read my book all the way through, I mean, I know for some people it would be assumed, but I don't think you know how much I adore and
Thank
admire
you.
and look up to Zhenya. So it
Thank
really
you.
means a lot. I think the short answer is, you know, look at who dominates the academy and journalism. It's men, and men write about other men, and men are the people in power. And so when you write about power, you tend to be writing about men. I did find it. There were times when I got quite frustrated in researching and writing this book, and I don't know if my anger sometimes comes through on the page. trying to write about Beda's victims, and calling up prominent historians
Let's
who.
define that Beria was the first lieutenant under Stalin, that he was the head of the NKVD, and then he was in charge of the Soviet atomic project.
Yes, so he oversaw the Gulag, a terrible, terrifying man who used his control over the Soviet Union's vast repressive machinery to literally snatch girls off the street or women off the silver screen and off the stages of the Soviet Union and rape them and cow them into silence. Most male historians of this period waved me off and were like, we don't really know if it was systemic. We don't really know if there's evidence. It's kind of, we don't know if we can trust this testimony because I drew some of the testimony from the case in the secret case against Beria when he was arrested after Stalin's death in 1953 and executed. But then I thought, Robert Conquest in his book about the Great Terror cites the testimony in these case files at length, with the necessary caveats that a lot of the testimony was obtained under torture. And but he takes it not quite at face value, but he uses it as a historical source. And I didn't see why I couldn't do that with the women who had testified against Beria in this case. And I think mo that to me was the most obvious case of his male historians ignoring it because it was about women, it was about rape, it was about sex. So it was something dirty and gossipy and tabloidy, and so let's and not serious. And I realized the extent to which I had myself fallen into the trap as a journalist, reporting on Moscow, reporting on Russia. You want to be taken seriously, and then you are drawn to the topics that you think are serious and everybody around you thinks are serious. And that's high politics, the military, the economy, numbers, guns, nobody, the social stuff, women, even though they're half the population, are seen as somehow soft and unserious as a topic, even though they're half the population. But because they're not represented the highest levels of power, the topic itself is seen as less than. And I think that's why people want to make careers, people want to get noticed, and they want to be seen as serious, so they write about the things that all the other men around them think are serious, and that's other men.
In the preface to your book, you write, in just shortly after the revolution, just in a couple of years, Soviet women were granted freedoms and rights that their Western counterparts would have to fight for, in most cases for another several decades. By 1917, Soviet women had the increasingly irrelevant right to vote years before their Western peers. They had the right to non-fault divorce and child support, paid maternity leave, and free higher education, including in the sciences, by 1918. By 1920, they had the right to abortion provided by the state for free. When I was reading this, and I was recalling that, when I was pregnant with my daughter Olga, our child support was $35 per month. It wasn't enough to buy a baby carriage. It wasn't enough to buy a bag. So my parents, they were fined in 1951 because they had my elder sister out of the wedlock.
The one.
That in 1951.
But I thought
And
that.
even though, both of them, they were already, over 30 years old, both of them went through the Great Patriotic War. My dad was a spy, who worked on the Nazi-occupied territory of Ukraine, even though he was a Jew. And my mom was an actress in the military theater. But the point is that apparently they were not allowed to have, to have a daughter outside the wedlock.
But it's again, all this stuff, this is why I laid it out in the introduction, because all of this stuff was revolutionary and sounded amazing. And it is still amazing that in 1918, 1920, one of the biggest countries in the world granted women these rights, rights that we're still fighting for in the US, and we still don't have, and some of which were taken away. That said, the implementation, the resources behind that the state invested in these ideas and these reforms, and the men at the top, and they were very quickly all men, their lack of belief in these ideas and the other needs that they felt the country had, very quickly ensured that these reforms went from revolutionary to either irrelevant or burdening the very women they were meant to emancipate. And so one of the reforms that the Bolsheviks introduced in 1918 was taking away the stigma of children born out of wedlock. You could still get child support in theory. You could still get child support from if you were a woman, from a man who was your child, you believed was the child's father, even if you weren't married. I think you can do that in some states in the US, but it's still kind of, again, in 1918, that's revolutionary. But by the time your parents got married, something like over 50 million Soviet people had been violently killed in between 1914 and 1945, and Stalin tasked Nikita Khrushchev with replacing the dead. And so this pronatalist fever took hold, which we still hear Putin echoing to this day, this all the talk of the demographic crisis. And they introduced a number of reforms designed to engineer a baby boom in the Soviet Union. They made divorce much harder to obtain. They started taxing people who didn't have kids or who didn't have enough kids, so you only stopped paying.
Abortion became illegal.
Well, abortion became illegal in 1936, so before the war, and then it was made legal again. They introduced this idea of the single mother that would be, and the state would be in place of the father, basically in loco parentis, everything to get women to have more kids. I didn't realize they were penalizing people for having kids out of wedlock when they were trying to get people to have more kids.
I can tell you more. The sex before marriage
Yeah,
was frowned upon.
definitely.
And partners were not allowed, in my time when I was growing up, and pa partners were not allowed into any hotels or hostels.
Yeah.
The first lessons in love we took place on window sills in the entrances of the buildings. And it was you couldn't talk. When I got married, I was very, very young. I was 16 year old. I was just fresh out of for the school. But it was
Which
like,
is interesting.
everybody was looking at my parents, and were asking them, Mark, is it okay that, Zhenya already married? And we were married because we wanted to have sex and we wanted to have, but it was impossible, when, you
Yeah.
couldn't get checked in anywhere,
I mean, and sometimes even after you were married, if you were a student in university, you couldn't visit each other's dorm rooms. You weren't allowed to live together, but then you also had to obey strict curfews. So the Gorbachevs had this issue when they got married. A woman that was my grandmother's roommate at the at in college in Kyiv had this problem. She got married and he had to come visit her in their room of six, and all the other girls would be locked out, and then somebody would call and say, "Hey, it's curfew, kick him out." Yeah, I know that we have so many family friends who during the Soviet period got married just to have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, just to be able to have sex. So people are on their fourth, fifth marriage because they got married at 18, were divorced by 20. So basically, they were boyfriends and girlfriends. But they just had to codify it. That rollback started almost immediately, but that's not where it started. It started with Kalanthai and her writing. So
That's what I
Alexandra
wanted
Kalanthai,
to ask you
yeah,
to
tell me. Okay.
tell me about tell you know probably a few people know about Alexandra Kollontai.
And I didn't know about her when I started this writing this book, when I
And you
started reading.
didn't see the movie? Yeah? There was a movie.
Yeah.
No? Okay.
So Alexandra Kollontai was the first female cabinet minister in the world. She was a Menshevik. Well, she came from the nobility, then she became a socialist, became a Menshevik. Then she switched to Lenin's side in April of 1917 and voted with him on the Central Committee to go forward with the seizure of power in October of 1917, for which he made her the Commissar of Social Welfare, which was a cabinet level position. She was one of the few Marxist theorists who really fleshed out how socialism was supposed to emancipate women, because the men, including Karl Marx and others, were just like, well, socialism will emancipate everyone, and therefore it will emancipate women. Kollontai wrote very specifically about women's specific needs and how they would the steps that would need to be taken to emancipate women. She also wrote extensively about love and sex and women's pleasure in a really radical way that
No, go into details because
I will tell you. I will tell you.
the
So
glass of
she,
water theory, you
well, the
know.
glass of water theory is a perversion of what she actually wrote. What she believed was that work, a woman's work, was the central defining aspect of her life. It's what gave her dignity as a person. It's what gave her life meaning and purpose. It wasn't marriage. It wasn't children. It was a woman's work. And she saw love as something she would do as kind of to take a break from work.
Right, like
Yeah.
drinking water, you know, what's
But that's
the
not what she wrote. What
difference?
she wrote actually was that a woman could drink from the cup of love until she felt satiated, and then she could say, that was nice, and go back to work, which was again the thing that gave her life meaning. It didn't mean it was a, it could be a one night stand, it could be a 1 year thing, it could be, you know, but it wasn't the point when she was writing this in 1913, wasn't that everything has to end in marriage or that sex is as it was in the 19th century and in the early 20th century in Russia and much of the West, sex was the province of either marriage or prostitution. And she tried to liberate it from that framework. Of course, and she lived that. She left her husband and her child to go pursue socialism in the West. Then she married a man much younger than herself, Pavel Dybenko. She had many lovers, and the men in the Bolshevik Party and in the Politburo constantly gossiped about her and effectively slut-shamed her. And after she was banished and exiled from the Soviet Union, she was made an ambassador to Norway, which wasn't an honorific, but a way to get her out of the country and out of the political debates, because she stood up to Lenin several times when he was consolidating control of the party. And they very quickly turned it on its head and said, oh, this was just encouraging promiscuity and this attempt to untether sex from marriage is super harmful. And they came up with this theory that a person has only a finite amount of energy, and any time that a person spends on sex, that wastes energy from channeling it into the revolution and building socialism. And they had a guy, Aron Zelkind, who was a man, obviously, and he wrote the, I think, 12 commandments of sex, and that was then what was taught to Soviet youth. And it was about, you know, saving yourself for marriage, that sex before marriage is unacceptable, that the more partners you have, the worse it is for your health, that again, having too many positions, too many partners, also bad for your health, again, saps your revolutionary drive. All these very reactionary, conservative, sexophobic views of sex that he then codified and became, were transmitted up to your generation in the Soviet Union. He also turned Kollontai's idea of drinking from the cup of love into the glass of water theory. as which is not what it was, but the idea was that, oh, Kalanthai sees sex as meaningless. She sees it as nothing more than drinking from a glass of water, and therefore it should be that these are not ideas we can get behind, and we have to strike them essentially from our thinking and from the record.
You see that Yuli Yoffe is a historian trained in Princeton University.
I wouldn't say I'm a historian. That was an undergraduate degree.
But anyway, she wrote her thesis in the Soviet studies, right? But when I've been once again, when I was reading your book, I was thinking that Soviet society was extremely moral. I'm serious about it. It was
Amoral?
extremely moral,
Moral or amoral?
immoral,
Amoral.
immoral. It was very well known, and now it's documented in different, books that there were orgies going on in the bureaucratic offices, in the Central Committee of the Communist Party offices, in the newspapers. I saw this myself. So, and
Of course,
that
the
was
more
at
you
the same
repress
time, yes, and at the same time, everything was forbidden. And there was the codex of the communist people. So I'm a little bit, aren't you concerned that people who will read you, especially the beginning of your book, they will ask, wait a second, you're writing about your family, that your mother, your grandmother, your great grandmother, all of them, they were doctors. They had these careers that were almost impossible for women in the West. And that's true. But at the same time, if you know the reality, you know that their life was extremely tough, is not to say shitty.
Which is what the book is about, which is about the way that the promises of the revolution very quickly gave way to the promises to made to women, the way very quickly turned into not just betraying those promises but exploiting women. And as I show in the book, because first of all, medicine, by the time my mother became a doctor in the late Soviet period, 70% of doctors were women in the Soviet Union. And
By the way,
America,
white.
I'll say it. So Americans are like, oh my God, wow, that's incredible how progressive. I'm like, no. But that 30% were men who were, so women clustered in the primary care specialties. So family medicine, gynecology, pediatrics, the tough kind of where there's a lot of work, a lot of stress, and very little pay. These were seen as feminized professions, therefore they were seen as less prestigious. They were not paid well. These women were worked to the bone. The men who were in medicine were the surgeons, were the tertiary care specialists, were the researchers, were the heads of hospitals. It wasn't the women. The women, like in every single field in the Soviet Union, were the draft horses. They were the beasts of burden. And medicine in the US was not medicine in the Soviet Union. It was medicine in the Soviet Union was had scarce resources. Abortions were all DNC abortions and were provided without anesthesia, because why would you give women anesthesia? If we have a shortage of anesthesiologists and anesthesia itself, why would you waste it on women who can bear great pain anyway, because that's just their nature. It was poorly resourced. The women doctors were closer to nurses or nurse practitioners in the US. And it was not seen as a super prestigious field the way it is here. It wasn't seen as a mark of great learning or great status the way it was here. My father recalls how an American acquaintance of his, when he found out that my mother was a doctor and my father was a computer programmer, was like, wow, you guys must have been very well off. And he said, no, our salaries together were less than what a bus driver makes. And the book is about how the revolution first extended these promises to women and then betrayed them. And not only did it not really, the women were saddled with the obligations, but didn't get the privileges, didn't get the support that they needed to be, fully emancipated members of society, and yeah, their lives were hard and shitty, and the book chronicles that, and about.
Exactly, and you're right that women had two jobs. They had job in in their workplace, but also then back home,
The double
they
burden.
absolutely. And average, according to the stats back then, average Soviet woman spent 7 hours per day for homework.
Yeah, on housework, but that's because she didn't have the mechanization and the appliances or the resources that her Western counterparts had. She didn't have vacuum cleaners. She didn't have a fridge a lot of the time. She didn't have a washing machine. So you had women, for example, living in communal apartments, washing their clothes by boiling them in a pot on a stove where everybody else is trying to boil their
I
clothes in
was
a pot.
boiling, diapers for
Yeah,
my
cloth diaper.
daughter, until she was probably 2 years old because there were no diapers.
Yeah.
There were only, clothing diapers.
Cloth
Yes.
diapers. Yeah. So you're trying to cook on the stove, boil your diapers on the stove, and everybody else in the communal apartment is trying to do the same. Forget appliances. There wasn't access to food. So, women spent time on their lunch breaks. I know my grandmother spent, she was out in Rublevo, which had beautiful forests around. So during her lunch break, she would go and forage for mushrooms and berries in the forest while overseeing the lab that in the water processing plant that provided drinking water to the Kremlin. Again, when I say that second part, Americans are like, wow, that's so fancy. But not the, she was foraging for mushrooms on her lunch break. And once you get those mushrooms, then you have to wash them, then you have to dry them, then you have to pickle them, then you have to, or dry them. It's immense labor. And my grandfather didn't help at all. Men were not expected to help at all. The women were also the only ones responsible for the child rearing. And that's after a full day of work. And then standing in line at grocery stores, trying to barter what they were able to get in terms of, let's say, clothing, shoes, repairing it. As I write in the book, a woman may have had a PhD, but she spent her evenings darning socks for her husband and kids after everyone was asleep.
Time and again, I hear this saying by Secretary Clinton that women's rights are human rights. And I totally agree with that. I subscribe to that. But I remember when Western feminists came to the Soviet Union, it was late 1980s. And I was working as a reporter of the Moskovsky Novosti, and I had my little one. My husband never changed a diaper. When I went to make an interview with the Minister of Health of the Soviet Union, Mr. Chazov, there was, this awful case where the kids were infected with HIV in Elista, in Kalmykia, because there were no disposable syringes available in the Soviet Union at all. They were available in the
Well,
Kremlin
as you
hospital.
wrote, so in my book, I quote extensively from Yevgenia's article that she wrote, where she reported her own birth, not your own birth, giving birth to your daughter. And
First pregnant, and then reporter gives birth on assignment.
yeah. So it was your pregnancy and the process of childbirth. And there's this memorable line where you kind of peek into the phlebotomist's office and you're like, I can see that she's washing syringes while there's an ad for fighting HIV. Outside her office, and you said she may have heard of disposable syringes, but I'm not sure she's ever seen one.
All right.
And that line really stuck with me.
But the point is that, by the way, my husband, he was a great intellectual, love of my life, he wrote 32 books.
Wow.
He was amazing, absolutely amazing man. But he begged me not to publish this article.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Because men didn't know what was going on in the maternity houses. They were not allowed in, and they had no idea. After I published this article, this series of articles, I received 15,000 letters from male who all over the world, wait a second, I couldn't imagine that my offsprings, they were They were born in such awful conditions where there was no shower, no bidet, no changing of, beddings. Nothing existed in the Soviet matter in Moscow. And I'm not going to tell you what was it like outside the Soviet Union. The reason I'm asking you about that, because there is a lot of misconception about the life in the Soviet Union. And that was, yes, Lenin was probably not exactly very good. Stalin was awful, and Khrushchev was better. Brezhnev was okay, Gorbachev was great. Other than that, there were bad leaders, but system was great. No, that was the essence.
Misconceptions here
Here
or in
in the
Russia? In
West,
Russia as well.
but in Russia, but here, there's this idea that, that socialism was okay. But no, it wasn't because it was perverted socialism. It was precisely because the kind of system, it was extremely humiliating to women. Just recall, there were no, intimate apparel. The first time I saw, normal bras when I got to Chicago as a reporter with the Chicago Tribune in 1990, it was the very first time when I saw that there was the possibility to buy the variety of normal clothing. And we were young women, and
There were no menstrual products. There was no contraception. The contraception that was available, I mean, I remember I had to take the rest of the day off when I found this in my research that one of the Soviet-made methods of contraceptions, well, first of all, the Soviet-made birth control pill had so many side effects that Soviet doctors were like, we're not going to prescribe this. The Soviet-made IUD had such a high rate of uterine perforations that nobody wanted to get them. And then I found that the Soviet Union made diaphragms out of metal. After I saw that and looked at a few pictures, I was like, I need to take a few more hours to just clear the memory cache. Because women's rights are human rights, but I don't think the Soviet Union believed much in anybody's human rights and anybody's dignity, but especially women. This idea was that women are beasts of burden, that they are tough, resilient, strong. They can do anything, and so they should be made to do anything. While the men are kind of these fragile, one-day butterflies, and we have to be there to, an endangered species, and we have to take care of them. I think what I found most infuriating in my research and in writing this book was this constant, and now we're seeing it in the US, but this constant idea of like, we've done enough for women, but look how sad the men are. They're so lonely, they're so sad, they're not as women are stronger and more resilient. Women will figure it out, they always do, but let's worry about the men. And Russia keeps coming back to this. Now, seeing this here in the US, I'm like, I mean, that's why that one of the only chapters in my book that's about the men is called The Weaker Sex, because that is how society views them in Russia. But the women are squat, cattle, like chattel, essentially.
You write about the woman sniper. Can you tell me, this is an amazing story. I didn't know about that. But you're sort of fascinated by this woman who killed, what, 1,200?
309
309.
in a year.
Yes. And then she came to the United States to raise money and she met with Chaplin. Would you please to tell the story?
So Lyudmila Pavlyuchenko signed up as a 25-year-old when the Nazis invaded. She had a sniper certificate from the state because girls in the first generation of Soviet girls received paramilitary training. Alongside the boys, they learned how to shoot. They learned how to read a topographical map. They learned about military history, etc. And there were all these clubs that young women and girls could join that would teach them how to fly an airplane, jump out of, be a paratrooper, become a sniper. So she had a sniper certificate. And she was initially turned away at the recruitment post. And the man there, who was older, who did, was not part of this revolutionary generation, said, go home and ask your husband. So she finally becomes a sniper. She is better than pretty much any sniper the Soviet Union has at the time. And Stalin sent her to the UK and the US to raise money for the Soviet war effort. And she meets Woody Guthrie, who writes a song about her, because these kind of left-leaning fellow travelers in the West are fascinated by this socialist woman who is killing fascists. Charlie Chaplin walks over to her on his hands, carrying a bottle of champagne in his teeth, then kisses her fingers and says, one for every fascist you killed. But at the same time, she sees
And she was very confused by that, by the way.
very, and she didn't like it. And she also didn't like that this American metals magnate who was recently widowed followed her around on tour, begging her to marry him. And Eleanor Roosevelt actually was like, oh, he then wrote to the Soviet embassy saying, "Can you? I would like to marry her." Eleanor Roosevelt was like, "You should really marry him." And she was like, "What is wrong with these people?" At news conferences, male reporters would ask her if she minded that her uniform made her look fat. They asked her what color lipstick she wore when she was, in her sniper's nest. One asked her what type of lingerie she preferred, which made her flip out, and she threatened to hit the reporter. Because it was just such a culture clash. The culture that she was coming from still had this revolutionary purpose. Stalin very quickly got rid of it. He undid co-ed education. He reintroduced home economics for girls, all these things that Krupska and the women revolutionaries had gotten rid of. But I was fascinated by her and by this generation of young girls who signed up to fight. There were over 800,000 of them. So nearly a million young Soviet women swarmed the recruitment posts in 1941 and didn't see anything weird about what they were doing. They were mostly young women who were born after the revolution. And no, all of them were born after the revolution. Some of them were 14, 16-year-old girls. And they didn't think that what they were doing was masculine. They didn't think they were women doing masculine things. They just thought they were doing human things, Soviet things, and they were Soviet people. My grandmother's cousin was a university student when the Nazis invaded, and she and her girlfriends all went to sign up to fight. And when they were put on a train, they thought they were going to the front, but they realized very quickly they were going east. So they jumped off the train and got on a train going to the front because they didn't see anything amiss with women fighting. There were all female fighter squadrons, fighter pilot squadrons. Women were paratroopers. They were artillery gunners. They were sappers. They did and especially now and in the US, where there's this debate raging again about whether women can perform in combat zones, and whether it's, whether they can meet these male standards, and that this is a very masculine kind of sanctuary that women shouldn't be allowed into. It was fascinating to read the accounts of these young girls, again, most of them teenagers, who did not see themselves. They still did very kind of girly things in the trenches. They would steal hydrogen peroxide from the nurse, from the medical tent, and dye their hair. They would rip up parachutes and make necklaces for themselves. There was one account I read of a young woman who married a fellow soldier, and her girlfriends got her bandages from the medical tent and sewed her a wedding dress out of them. And then she went back to being a soldier. Like they weren't, didn't see themselves as women enacting male roles. They were just being themselves. And it was like, oh, this can be done. This doesn't have to be a male-only field, and you don't have to twist yourself into knots thinking about whether women can do this or should do this. They can, and if they want to, they should.
Right. But they also, many of them, they were what was called PPSH, походные or
Field wives.
field wives. And then, there was a lot of, once again, it was a little known story about these field wives who were returning back after, they.
So explain what a field wife is.
But, please, go
So,
ahead.
a field wife was somebody who a lot of these officers had wives back home, and they would take these field wives, right? So while they were at war, you obviously need a wife. So a lot of these women got pregnant, had kids, But the men, when the war ended, went back to their legal wives. And because of that, a lot of the women who were not involved with these married men at the front were also seen as suspicious. When they came back from the war, other women shamed them and said, "You slut, you were sleeping with somebody's husband. What were you doing in such intimate proximity to the men in the trenches?" And because of the insistence on traditionalism, on conservative family values, on heteronormativity after the war, the women who had fought and done these incredible things were forced to shut up. Their memoirs weren't published, or if they were kind of hidden, and they weren't encouraged to talk about it because immediately the specter of the field wife would come up. But everybody had them. Zhukov, the great
Marshals.
Marshal Zhukov had a couple, Brezhnev had a couple.
They
The men,
had,
of course, suffered no consequences for this, but because of what the men did, all the women at the front were now suspect, which was to me so tragic because of these incredible things that these young girls did.
Hey, but also you would think that, this country lost 27 million people in during the course of the war. And you would expect that, kind of the nation was in bad need of babies.
And it
Yeah.
was. And so Khrushchev set about engineering a baby boom. And he drew up these policies in 1944 that borrowed, for example, from Nazi Germany, the concept of military style medals for women who had lots and lots of babies. He introduced basically the idea of Matka-Pitel, paying women to have children. So the more children she had, the more money she got, and the more the state promised to take care of them. They introduced a tax on childlessness. They introduced the idea that a woman could have children outside of wedlock and be kind of a protected legal and social category. Because basically, what happened is most of the 27 million people who were killed in the war were men. And there were many stories, both anecdotal and in the archives, of one man coming back to the village and his wife passing him out to all the other women so that they could have children. The state basically incentivized men to stay married to their wives but impregnate lots of other women who are not their wives, while freeing them of the consequences of it. So women who had children with men they were not married to, couldn't put their names on the man's name on the birth certificate, couldn't ask for child support from him. This all basically shifted, that burden shifted to the state because it was like, we'll have kids by hook or by crook. And these policies were successful. He got a baby boom, but a third of those babies were born out of wedlock. And then you had this whole generation of Soviets who didn't have fathers, who didn't even understand the idea of fathers, and you had these однополые, right? Something that is much maligned in Putin's Russia of same-sex families, i.e. gay families, but so tens and tens of millions of Soviets and then Russians were raised in single-sex families, i.e. by a mother and a grandmother, because there were
No
just
man.
no men around. And that also very much formatted people's gender consciousness, first in the Soviet Union and Russia.
But also it was, due to the that the male expectancy, life expectancy was much lower than, the women. And there was, 35 million alcoholics in the Soviet Union. And therefore, a lot of 35 million out of 300 million people. And therefore, male, they were basically not present in the families because they were drinking and
Yeah, but they also, in terms of just culturally, socially, they weren't encouraged to be present in the family because housework was a woman's work, child rearing was a woman's work, and a man's work was just work. But in a totalitarian society, what kind of work can you really do that brings you meaning and dignity? And if there's no really meaningful career path or path to self-actualization. So men became marginalized politically, they became marginalized socially and in their families. And given the traumas of the war, a lot of them took to drink and they just became these wilting, vanishing, fragile creatures. And was it Mikhail Denisenko, who's a demographer at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow? It's like after the war, there were no antidepressants, there were no therapists, there's no understanding of
There never
PTSD.
been any
Yeah,
antidepressants.
but there was vodka, there was alcohol. And a lot of these older men who had come back from the front because they didn't want to drink alone drank with young boys who didn't have fathers. They drank in the yards, so they introduced the younger generation to the bottle.
Fast forward. You left Russia with your parents in 1990. You were 7 year old. There's an amazing story about you being, in the first and second grades, and the way that you were treated. I encourage you read this book because it's really will give you, the understanding what was the life like for kids and for women. But then you return back. So you graduated from Princeton. And you were hired as a fact check at the New Yorker. And now, of course, probably know that, Yulia published quite a few articles in the New Yorker, including the profile of Alexei Navalny. And just recently, the latest New Yorker carries a chapter of her book about, this.
Women hunting for husbands.
Yes, in the contemporary Russia. So tell me, why did you decide to go back? And so many of, or kids who left Soviet Union, they returned back. I saw them. Why?
Yeah.
What was so attractive about, this Russia?
I can't speak to the others, but for me, I was always interested, or I became very interested in Russian literature, Soviet history, because Soviet history was better than any literature. Like nobody could imagine this from their head, what actually happened in real life. It was better than any novel. Michael Edov once said that the reason that so much of 1990s Russian literature was so phantasmagorical, you had lesbian vampires, and there is because a novel has to take reality and juice it up a little bit. But if you take Russian reality and juice it up, like you immediately get into the phantasmagorical.
It was the editor-in-chief of
Russian GQ.
GQ.
Yeah, now he's a screenwriter and all that. But he, anyway, so I was always interested. And then also I was living in New York after college, and I didn't find that there was much to write about here. Like I didn't want to write about art. I didn't want to write about finance. I didn't want to write about fashion. I was just not interested. And I was interested in what was happening, but I went back. Was kind of an accident. I was going back and forth between being a lawyer and a lawyer or a doctor, like the two acceptable career paths. And at the same time, I was like, I want to try writing, I want to try reporting, but I don't know what to write or report about in New York. It's so saturated with everybody trying to be a New Yorker writer, while writing about, some random person in Brooklyn or some party on the Upper East Side. And that was all very boring to me. And so I applied for the Fulbright. And I was sure I wouldn't get it. And I asked my college professor, Stephen Kotkin, to write me a recommendation for the Fulbright. And he said, okay, but on one condition, because I wrote a recommendation letter for the Fulbright for Boris Fishman, who preceded me as a fact checker, Russian-speaking fact checker at the New Yorker. And he said, I wrote him a recommendation, he got the Fulbright, and then he didn't go. And I don't want it to ding my reputation again. So I'll write you a recommendation. And if you get it, you have to go. And I was like, fine, because I'm not going to get it. And my plan was, okay, I'll wrap up my last year of having fun in New York and exploring media. And then I'll restart my pre-med because I started off college as pre-med. So I was going to be a doctor like all the women in my family. And then I'll just go to Columbia and start the post-bac program to take on my medical school requirements. And then I got accepted to the Fulbright and I was like, oh shit.
Now I have to go because then Kotkin will be mad at me, and I think I'm still so scared of him. And I was like, I don't want him to disown me, and so I went, and I was like, I'll just stay for 3 months, and then I'll just, instead of starting the post-bac program at Columbia in September, I'll do the accelerated one that starts in January.
And 3 years later, you return back.
But it was addictive. Russia was, at the time, was addictive. There's a reason you miss it. There's a reason I miss it. Especially then, it was this, what we now realize was this very finite window of thaw. And
During Medvedev's,
Medvedev,
you know, when Medvedev was some sort of substitute president or something like that.
the chair warmer, the seat
Oh,
warmer.
yeah.
And there was really a feeling that Russia was going to take a different path and live up to the potential we all thought it had. And these nights of sitting in Jean-Jacques or Maillard talking about democracy and whether what kind of democracy would work for Russia and what did it mean to be a journalist in this society, and talking about, you just felt like you were in it, like you were it, you were not just witnessing history happening, you were part of history happening. The history that I had always read about and was so intoxicated by, and I never wanted to stop. It just,
Then why did you leave?
because I didn't want to be a woman in Russia. I didn't want to marry a Russian man. I didn't want to raise children in Russia. I didn't want, and I was almost 30, so I was like, I gotta get on this. I can't, and I can't marry somebody, because the ticking clock for Russian women is insane. And I was told, my mother told me when I was in college, she was like, meet somebody in college, because after college it'll be too late. The good ones will already be taken. She wasn't
But
wrong.
now you have a great husband,
He's wonderful, but
beautiful
I had to wait for the second wave.
boy.
I had to wait for his divorce, right?
Just
But I was like, I'm almost 30, and so I'm really pushing it, and I don't want to marry a Russian man, because look at Russian men. They're a disaster.
I remember that you were not so sure about that when you were in Moscow.
Oh no, I no. I mean, you know who I'm talking about, but
Yes, of course.
I kept getting back together with him because I was like, well, I moved back to the US and I haven't met someone yet, and it's already been 3 months, and he still really likes me, and so I guess I'll do that. But I mean, the whole, but I was like, I can't marry a Russian man. They all drink, they're all useless, they're all just like, I felt like I was his mom.
I see one Russian man here. Yeah, good
Well,
one.
they all think that. Yeah, and then I was like, I didn't, I saw what the Soviet or the Russian healthcare system was like. I was like, I don't want to have to go to the doctor here. I don't want to have children that go to the doctor here. I can do a whole like talk about all the crazy Russian medical stories I've heard. My mom is a pathologist, a subspecialty is breast and GYN, so she diagnoses breast cancer, she diagnoses ovarian cancer, cervical cancer, things like that. And she organized a little conference in Moscow, and afterwards, and pathologists share difficult cases with each other. They send each other slides around the world to consult each other and say, I had a hard time with this one. Can you tell me what you think? So a pathologist she met in Moscow sent her some slides and said, this woman has aggressive breast cancer. We've already done a mastectomy. She's about to start chemo and radiation, but we're having a hard time staging it. We're having a hard time figuring out if it's stage two or stage whatever. And my mom looks at it and she's like, this is not cancer. This was not, this woman never had cancer. Love it. Like, let's get on the phone and talk about this. And the person never called her back. Then they sent her a second case and said, we're pretty sure this is nothing, but can you confirm? She was like, this person has aggressive breast cancer. And then they stopped sending her cases. So yeah, that's why I was like, I can't, like, this, it's fascinating to play here, but it was a kind of never never land.
I think for a lot of us, repets, as I called us. But actually undoing what our parents did and settling down there, I think for a lot of us was a bridge too far and was seen as kind of a betrayal of our parents and their choice. So,
I see.
anyway, sorry, that was a very long answer.
No, that's very, I think it's fascinating to, I want to ask you about, you write about them, these so-called children's rights commissioners, for the President of the Russian Federation. There is one, Мария Львова-Белова, and just recently, there have been published a recording of conversation that, this Мария Белова, who is in charge of children's rights in Russian Federation, and she's telling the story
Well, she
that
has an ICC warrant out for her arrest
yes,
for kidnapping Ukrainian children, tons of
that's
them.
exactly that. She adopted the boy from Mariupol, and Mariupol, of course, now occupied by the Russian troops, and she complained that this boy was singing Ukrainian songs. Pick up.
She has said this before in other interviews and other appearances where she said, "Oh, he was so happy I rescued him from Mariupol and from the crazy Ukrainians." But he was challenged, and when we brought him home, he chased around because she has about like 37 children, and she's like, "He chased around my other children, calling them Moskalin around the house." So, Moskal is a Ukrainian derogatory term for a Russian. And now she, this interview,
No, derogatory term for Russians will be Katsapai.
sorry, for
Katsapai
Moskvite.
for Moscovites, yes.
And she said in this most recent interview, she said that he hated Russians and he was trying to speak Ukrainian and sing Russian songs and was reading, sorry, reading you, reading Ukrainian news channels like on his phone and singing Ukrainian songs and trying to speak Ukrainian, and she was discouraging him from doing that. And she said, actually, this was a great act of self-sacrifice because he really ruined things in our family for a little while. Philippe, I think, is his name. And for a long time, she would trot him out at on various stages, and she had him give an interview to Tsargrad.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not.
Tsargrad is a nationalistic TV channel.
Yeah, it's like OANN.
Yeah.
And this is not a kid who's well, or a young man who's well. And but again, she's modeling this. She was a priest's wife. She had five kids. Then she adopted, I think, seven more, and then th 13 or 14 were her. She had guardianship over them. But she made her whole career on this new image of what a new Russian woman under Putin and his kind of wartime regime was supposed to look like. Like a priest's wife who has 87 children and promotes conservative values. Her predecessor was her friend, her name keeps
Кузнецова.
Кузнецова, Анна Кузнецова, who was married to a priest, had her seventh child while in office. And promoted the theory of telegyny, which is the pseudoscience that a woman who has had multiple partners, her uterus stores the genetic memory of her previous partners, and therefore any children she has with her husband will be genetically messed up because there will be all this conflicting information in her uterus.
21st century, right?
21st century, but that's what's being promoted as this kind of this ideal of Russian womanhood. It's also, again, very acquisitive, and it's all about cleansing Ukrainian children of their cultural identity, which is genocidal, to put it mildly. Yeah. And she also, but what I love about Belova, which I didn't put in the book because it was already getting very long, was that for all her kind of family values and going out there and telling young women to get married early and start having kids early because that way you can have more kids because you have more time, and that you can still work and do all this. It came out that she was cheating on her husband, who became a priest. He was a programmer, I think, and then he became a priest. She was cheating on him with Constantine Malefiev. Did you know this?
No,
She was cheating
really.
on him with Constantine Malefiev, who left his
What
wife.
about family values?
I mean, what about sovereign democracy? And she left her priest husband, and she and Malefiev got married, and all the kind of Kremlin royalty went to their little wedding. And
Constantine Malefiev is an oligarch who financed the so-called uprising in the eastern Ukraine back in 2014, which allowed Putin to bring so-called volunteers. These were Russian troops, but they were dressed not as Russian soul officers anyway. So, and Constantine Malefiev financed this.
He also owns Tsargrad, which is this media network that's all about monarchy, the church, traditional family values. But yeah.
So what is your take on this traditional family values? Why did Putin go into that? After all, he served in Germany, he was very, he was for quite a while, everybody kept saying that Putin was the only European in Russia. Everyone were Asians, we were bad,
Oh, well, that's
meaning,
the whole thing that the Tsar is always the most European
Of
person.
course, of course. And that's all of, the all Russians are barbarians, but Putin was the only European. Can you explain why did he decide to go into the traditional values? What is your
Because
take of
it's
that?
why is America going toward traditional values? First of all, I think it's usually skin deep. And as I remember Steve Kotkin teaching us that if there are laws banning something over and over and over again, it means people don't want to do that. People want to keep doing the thing that they're trying to ban. I think some of it is about propping up a declining population. Part of it is about social control, and seeing the family as the unit in which government, society, and government is built. And so, if you control people through that, through conservative family values, where they're subservient to the church, the patriarch, then they're subservient to the state. I think it's about that. It's also about trying to boost birth rates, which they have not been able to successfully do.
He's killing, he allows, there are more than 1 million Russian, predominantly male, killed, wounded, or disappeared,
But it's not working. He declared 2024 the year of the family. He had a pageant, a televised pageant of многодетные семьи, so
The
families that have, I think, more than four or five kids.
yes.
And it was like, choose the best family that has a bazillion kids. And they all came out in matching outfits. It was insane. But women are not listening. Like, women, the birth rate in 2024, the year of the family, was the lowest it had ever been since Putin took power in 1999. Because people see that the economy is not stable. They see there's a war raging. Their men are being sent off to fight. Why would you have a child in these circumstances? Moreover, what's interesting is there's all this pronatalist stuff has been trying to, led by the church, with help from American evangelicals, have been trying to chip away at abortion rights in Russia, and they've become more and more restricted. It's harder and harder to get an abortion, but it's still a Rubicon that the Kremlin can't cross, because they understand that women and men wouldn't allow it, because it's still because people have gotten used to it over 100 years, and they know that people would just turn to back alley abortions again. It's just, I just recently read an article about it that they, oh, also speaking of traditional family values, they're also now trying to give the incentivize teenage girls to have babies. BBC Russian Service wrote about it. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, family values, but really we just need more people, more soldiers. I remember you telling me that over dinner at when we both still lived in Moscow. You said, house. That if you have a boy as a woman, you're just basically giving the country a soldier. It's all about soldiers for the motherland.
As we speak, there is information for the new chapter of the second edition of your
Oh,
book.
Jesus. Oh, no.
Diana Loginova, yes, Naoka, an 18-year-old street singer from the St. Petersburg. Her band, Stop Time, sang forbidden songs in the contemporary Russia, written by Monetochka and by Noisy
I
MC.
see.
Yes. So, and now, she and her guitarist and her drama player, they were sentenced to 13, 14 days in jail. But now, she was today released, immediately arrested, and most likely she's facing a jail time. So, would you please to comment on that? Why, she's once again a young girl, a young woman, in the country which is consumed by fear, because there are more political prisoners than there were political prisoners under Brezhnev or Andropov or Chernenko. So I mean, post-Khrushchev times, there are more than 1,500. All my friends are either in jail, all my each and everyone, either in jail or in exile. There is no one left.
Or dead,
No, or dead,
murdered.
of course, murdered. Right. And once again, we see that a young woman, Diana Loginova, her pseudonym is Naoka, she went for this amazing protest, and all of a sudden, young kids across Russia, they're coming out on the streets. And they're singing these songs by Monetochka and Noisy MC, who, of course, pronounced, criminals, foreign agents, enemies of the state.
I think her renditions of the songs were better than the originals. I'll say that. I think she's incredibly brave. I think it's part of a long tradition of Russian women, Soviet women standing up to the state or trying to. But what I worry about is this expectation that women will save the country. I remember it when Russia launched its full-scale invasion in February 2022. Everybody kept asking me, well, surely, when the body bags start coming home, soldiers' mothers and wives will come out into the streets and force Putin to stop the war. And my question was, why is it on them? They have no political power. They didn't start the war. Why did they yet again have to save the country from itself? By
And you're
risk,
right about that.
by risking life and limb and liberty. Why don't the men just stop with their bullshit? And, then the women won't have to do this. But this kind of extra burden that is constantly placed on Soviet women or Russian women to be more moral than the rest of society, their society, more brave, more,
Skinny.
yeah, but it's just like, you're not, you can't be a real human. You're supposed to be this kind of saintly version of a person, but at the same time, you're this, like I said, this beast of burden. I don't think it's a fair expectation. So Naoka is incredibly brave, and I wish there were a way to help her from here. But the expectation that women will, it's kind of like after the Parkland shooting here in the US in Florida. And the students started banding together and protesting in Washington, and people were like, oh, the kids will save us. I'm like, how about the adults save us? They're the ones with the political power. They're the ones who created this problem. Why don't they save us instead of the kids who are learning how to hide from shooters and everything? I don't think it's a, not that this is your expectation, but I'm saying it's the societal expectation that the least empowered members of society be the ones that save it from its leaders.
So my theory is that in Russia, women, they're really a knack of Russian politics. And the reason why, because we have to raise kids. When the Soviet Union fell apart and collapsed, and our husbands, they were really terrified, and they were laying in beds day and night, and they were complaining about lack of money and impossibility to make money. And we didn't have this choice. I had to raise my daughter. For God's sake, I couldn't allow myself to complain because, and that's what happened to many, many women who went, immediately so many bureaucratic agencies were closed, and women, a lot of women were in these bureaucratic agencies, and they went into doing all kind of businesses, cooking, making cakes, selling naski, and pirashki on the streets.
Again, it's that the expectation that women will save everyone, but still be incredibly skinny and beautiful and feminine and soft and dainty
And great lipstick.
and great looks and also subservient to the men. While even though the men can't stand up on their own, still we have to do everything, save the men from themselves, and then be subservient to them. It's possible.
I have many more questions, but I really want to open the floor to the audience. I just have to say one thing. You're right. We first met at Alexei Navalny's birthday party, and that we
Was
were
that
very
where we?
close. Yes. That was
I
the first time we met.
oh, it wasn't at New Times offices?
No, I remember you very well. I remember you very well. And you write that, at some point you clashed with Alexei because his speech at the Ruski March was anti-Semitic. He never was anti-Semitic.
I didn't
He
say
was a
he
very
was.
close friend of mine.
I didn't say he was anti-Semitic. I said he used, I tweeted it at the time that he used anti-Semitic tropes in the speech in front of an audience that would understand that. And he was talking about
Abramovich.
Abramovich and your other, who was it Abramovich? And then there was another oligarch with a very recognizably Jewish name. He says, Piotr Skoprov.
No, he didn't say
Yes,
this.
yes.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, I tweeted about it. He called me and we yelled at each other for a while. But I was, I like I said, I always respected his ability to debate and change his mind and learn and evolve, which is very rare for a politician anywhere.
I always, my idea was that it was important to speak, not to divide Russians into good Russians and bad Russians. And there were Russian nationalist young people who were from deprived parts of the country, and somebody who considered himself a politician had to go to them and speak to them, not to be afraid of them, because they were saying all kind of
But is that how
nice
it, but
words.
is that how, I agree with you, but is that how it started?
Yes, because I wrote his first manifesto. Narod. Yes. So anyway, yes, that, as always. So anyway, so
But I write about him in the book very
yes.
complimentarily.
No, and there is a great chapter about Yulia, Alexei Navalny's widow, who now, is becoming one of the leaders of the Russian opposition, and etc. It's, I mean, trust me, it's a book that, that worth reading. Absolutely, 100%. So questions, please. Yes, Alexei Friedland.
From Preston's
From our presses, right?
Russian man.
A good one.
Sort of Russian, right. By the way, author of a great book about the Soviet kid in the Soviet army.
Oh, what's it
Amazing book.
called?
Yes, it's called Chuzhaya Yudoль. Yes.
But my question is, could you speak, or is it a part of your research about tradition of acceptance or not acceptance of women in power? We know that in the 18th century, most of the century, Russia was being held at least a high position, right? Three empresses for it. And then during Soviet times, which is the focus of your research, I remember women, first secretary of Краснопресненский Крайком Party, Communist Party, or that or this. There is some
Furtwängler, also Minister of Culture.
et cetera, my grandmother, but instance some others. Then there was, as you know, Ronald Reagan on a flight to see Gorbachev in Geneva. Was the first meeting in Geneva?
Reykjavik.
Reykjavik was second.
Asset.
Yeah. So he watched the movie Moscow Doesn't Bleed in Tears. Is it really a fairy tale? Because office accepts the woman in power, and then there is Alyosha, and so on and so forth, that story. Then there is a second movie, which I don't know how to translate, Служебный роман, the novel of a former
Office
office
romance.
story, right? That one is also about a woman in power. Was those fairy tales or not? And were there a class of women in power, and who were they?
They were allowed to be in certain positions. They were good. They were very good bureaucrats. There was a basically the stereotype of a Russian, of a Soviet woman, was that she was, organized and disciplined, and that she could discipline the men who were all just, these useless man children. And that's why you often find women in accounting. If you have women in the C-suite of Russian companies, they're usually the CFOs. This idea that they can be trusted to count the money, to keep everybody in line, to keep everybody disciplined. They make great school principals. They make great kind of lower level administrative figures. But the higher you get, I mean, there were sociological studies done in the late Soviet period where men and women in the Soviet Union said that women just don't have these qualities naturally to lead, that this is better left to the men. And you still see it echoed in polling in Russia today, that both Russian men and women just don't think that past a certain ceiling, it's appropriate for women to be there.
Full acceptance of the Catherine the Great,
Of what?
Elizabeth the Second, the Catherine
But
the
that was
First,
Dabila.
but they're kind of elevating them today on the and have been elevating them from
But they
there.
elevate Mandelstam and Pushkin, like when you elevate a historical figure who's dead and can't speak for themselves, it's very convenient because you can just pick and choose which parts of them to elevate. When was the last time Russia had a female ruler? And Furtseva, you mentioned Furtseva, she was the first and last one after Kalantai, who left her post in 1918 or 1919, very soon after. She left in protest over Lenin's decision to pull out of World War I.
Matviyenko. Matviyenko.
But she's nobody.
But she's still a
Well,
woman.
yeah.
Oh, Matviyenko, she's a woman.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, on paper, she has a very high-ranking position.
But I'm saying, I'm just saying that in the Soviet period, there was Kalantai and there was Furtseva, and that was it.
In the post-Soviet, there was her Kamada minister, but she had a very hard time precisely because she was a woman.
And
No.
then the women that do have cabinet positions deal with health care,
Yeah,
children,
exactly.
family, or finances.
Elvira Nabiullina, of course, and
Finances,
finances.
exactly, because men are spendthrifts. They'll drink through all the money. They can't be trusted with it. The women will count every kopeck and can be trusted. But that historically, at least for the last 150 years, women are seen as kind of the mops, the disciplinarians, the ones who will keep everything organized and counted, and slap your hand when you reach for the cookie jar.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Me?
Yes.
Yes. Hi. So my name is Katya Kazak, and I'm also a
By
journalist.
the way, I'm sorry, before we proceed, I have to tell you that we're going to download this. It's recorded. It's download. So be aware that if you ask questions and you don't want to see yourself on YouTube, then be aware that it will be recorded. Yes. So Katya, please.
Fascinating conversation. Thank you so much. I look forward to reading your book. I have a question before I ask. I may just want to share one thing, just because what you were discussing, the absurdity of Soviet lives and communal apartments. I have an 11-year-old daughter who is learning Russian, and just this weekend we were shown her a Russian book with photographs, kind of very antiquated pictures of Sasha is reading, Masha is biking, and there was this one picture where it was Katya or someone in a room. It was like this little container, Kazik, and the girl was doing something with this little kind of a shallow bowl. And I said, and it didn't have a, it didn't say what the girl was doing. And I said, oh, Katya is washing clothes. Katya is doing laundry. And my daughter said, no, she's doing pottery. I was like, no, she, or maybe it was the other way around. She was convinced that there's no way somebody is washing clothes this way.
Yeah.
That it must be pottery. She said, absolutely, she's doing pottery with her arms. And I said, no, she's washing clothes in this little. And anyway, it was just such an incredible reminder of just, I don't know, just
How we used to
how
live.
we used to live and how absurd it looks now to like to your point that there were no dishwashers, washing machines, like women had to do so much. But I have a question for you, and this is something that I haven't figured out, and I feel like it kind of fucked me up in my life a little bit. And it's the idea of love and romance in the woman's role in the Soviet kind of society, because I feel like if I wonder if in your research you found something that was not just it just happened because I don't know if it was institutionalized, but the idea of romantic love and the idea of woman's role in that, this almost like a fantasy, what you were talking about before, that a woman is a queen, is a powerful ruler at some point. But, a woman, in addition to everything else, that she had to do and then do work, there was also this fantasy of love, right? And there were movies and there was poetry and there were plays and it was all kind of
But it was all very cartoonish because
not
it's a
necessarily so
society.
dramatic and everything and like but was there some systemic, I don't know if you found any evidence of just a broader kind of a, I don't know, not power, but like a play to keep, maybe it was to keep women in line as well, but I'm just curious about that.
It's not something I really write about in, well, it is something I write about in the book because most, I think, a lot of marriage in the Soviet Union and I think to this day in Russia is prosciutto. It's about, what is, it's not about love and romantic feeling. It's about practicality. And oh, he's a good earner. He'll be a good father, I might not find him very physically attractive, but he has a lot of money, or, there's no one else. I think the idea of romantic love is a fantasy, just like that Russian women have, just like the idea of marrying wealthy and being able to stay at home and just, have massages and become an interior decorator while your husband makes all this serious money. But that's not an attainable dream for a lot of Russian women. And you can see it in the kind of craziness and the hunger and the panic with which they hunt for mates. There's this sense that there aren't very many men around, and the ones that are there aren't really easy to fall in love with. They drink and they drink, they hit you. And I find that a lot of the portrayals of romantic love in Russia are either incredibly cartoonish, and sexuality also are very cartoonish, like ballroom dancing or figure skating, or this, it's very over the top and not real, or it's very permissive of, yeah, I love him. He's just a little useless and he drinks a lot and he cheats on me, but he's mine, and that's just how men are. Yeah.
It's just such hypocrisy, I
Yeah.
think.
I think, except for maybe in the certain circles of the intelligentsia, I don't know a lot of Russians who marry for love.
No,
Oh.
you're not right.
No.
Except for, no,
A lot of us.
no, I'm saying in the intelligentsia, I know a lot of people who did, but kind of people outside of it, the people I know from outside of our circles in Moscow, a lot of it was prosciutto.
Just, when Chekists came into power, it became fashionable to have a wife and a mistress. And that was became, there were all this, it's just, it became sort of a rule of the game. If you want to show out that, you're a
That
real
you're a
man, you
man.
have money, you are not going to go on vacation with your wife. So своим самоваром.
My very close family friend, who's a very successful businessman in Russia still, would tell me, he was like, that his clients, business partners would be like, is everything okay? Do you have like erectile dysfunction? What, why do you not? He was like, no, I just like my wife. I don't want a mistress. And they were like,
Yes, please.
oh, sorry.
Oh, sure.
They called him.
Ah,
Sorry.
yes.
I'm
Of
sorry.
course,
Sorry.
of
Hear
course.
the
Please.
lady first.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you more about Kollontai. And I have a whole bunch of different questions. I'm really looking forward to reading this book. I'm a huge, huge fan. When I read the New York Times review, I was a little bit taken aback by the line that says something like, along the way, she introduces us to this figure, Kollontai. And I thought, huffily, what do you mean introduce? Like, who doesn't know? I mean, anybody who would read this book. So I'm shocked to hear that she wasn't already a kind of major figure for you. And I'm wondering, it's not, I mean, maybe it's a question about the book, but it's really also a question of what do you, how do you think about her? And how have you talked to women in your family about how they thought about her? And what role does she play as a kind of, if any, as a kind of symbol or guiding star or
So I think in defense of the reviewer, I think she meant introduces us as an
oh,
introduces her as a character in the book.
that
I
makes
didn't
sense, yeah.
know about her. I mean, she's just like these women are not parts of the official canonical Soviet history because they were very quickly sidelined and then written out of history. As for which what role they had, my not no, my parents. I had to, even when the book was finished and I got galleys, I had to plead with my father to read the parts that were about the Soviet history. Because he was like, it's boring, it's trash, it's all lies. You know, it's that deep cynicism about Soviet history, Soviet anything that I think that last generation of Soviets had, which was, it's all a lie. We had to memorize it for our exam in social scientific socialism or scientific atheism or dialectical materialism, name your course that you were forced to take. And they have just this lifetime allergy to it. He didn't want to read it. He was like, I just read the chapters about our family. And only when he realized that that insulted me did he go back and read this stuff. He was like, oh, I actually didn't know about this stuff. My grandmother, when she read first draft, she was like,
Emma.
yeah, she was like, this is boring. This is stupid. These are socialist lies. They're communist lies. Why are you writing about this?
And for you?
I think she was a complicated person, just like all people are. She had really extraordinary and brilliant and revolutionary ideas. She put a lot of them into practice in her own life. But she advocated for the Bolshevik coup in October 1917. I don't think that's great. She was complicated. She served the Soviet state. She believed in it. And like Zhenya, I believe that it was a fundamentally flawed vision from the beginning. So I just see her as a historical figure, but also as a person, and all people are complicated and not two-dimensional.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I haven't read the book yet. Look forward to it. But from personal experience, I'm sort of struggling with some discontinuities in some of the argument. Like half of my family is Russian. My grandparents came of age in the interwar years, and I couldn't imagine something more paternalistic. My grandmother ran the house, and it was always shocking to me growing up as a Canadian kid that she'd go back to the kitchen and eat. She'd serve the table. The family, and then she'd go and eat in the kitchen. And that was very much the practice. So this flowering of sort of women's rights under the Soviet times, I didn't have any direct evidence of that. Also, you talk about wartime experience. Well, women in North America had similar experiences during the war, but perhaps in the factories and in ferrying airplanes and things like that. And sure, there was a reaction at the end of the war, but that really, I think, set a lot of, women's rights and that process in place in North America, and how it got squelched in Russia, but perhaps carried on in North America. And I guess the final one is my first visit to the Soviet Union was in 1988. And the shocking thing for me was in women in roles that I had no idea of, women driving steam shovels, driving buses, and in what appeared to be very egalitarian roles, in openly in the
So you
society there.
your point three contradicted your point one a little bit, no?
I guess, but it's what you said. The argument you seem to be making is that women had these great rights that came out of the revolution and under Lenin, and then those were gradually eroded. And what I'm seeing is I have a data point that says they were actually in medieval times at the beginning, went through the war, and at least in modern Russia, of course there are issues and they came in, but I saw more egalitarian in certain areas and in certain respects, unexpected respects for me in the 80s compared to my experience in North America.
So for first I would say I think the book would answer a lot of these questions.
Okay.
And I think I alluded or spoke directly to some of the stuff earlier in our conversation, which was that women were granted some of these rights, but were also still expected to keep home in medieval conditions. And neither the society nor the leadership of the country, once people like Kollontai were sidelined, really truly embraced these ideas and very quickly undid them while realizing, oh, but we have a larger workforce if we ask women to work. And what you mentioned of American women had a completely different war than Soviet women. First of all, it wasn't fought on their soil. They didn't lose family members at the same rate. They waited for their husbands and fathers and brothers to come back, but the war happened somewhere else. For Soviet women, it happened right there and in their homes. And while American women went into the factories and into the workforce to replace the men that went to war in the 1940s, Soviet women had been there for generations already. Russia, pre-revolutionary Russia on the eve of the revolution, had one of the highest female labor participation rates in the world. It was also a very radicalized labor force, but women had been doing these factory jobs for decades by the time American women took those roles on in the 40s and then were pushed out, whereas Soviet women stayed in those roles. And also, I mean, A, because they've been there, and B, because there were no men to push them out after the war. They were all dead. And the second thing was American women never participated in active combat in World War II. There weren't American women snipers. There weren't all female fighter pilot regiments or fighter bomber
That's kind of
regiments.
my point, though, because now, in spite of that, they seem to have made much greater progress after the war
Here? Because
than in Russia.
American women have fought for them and all for these rights, and they keep getting rolled back. Pete Hegseth is pushing them out of combat roles.
Right.
We lost our right to abortion a few years ago. Russian women didn't fight for any of these rights. They were granted to them, and then they, instead of being implemented as rights, were just kind of obligations or things that existed only on paper, without the necessary support. So they just ended up being extra obligations that women had to fulfill. But I think the book will answer a lot of your questions.
Okay, thank
How are
you.
we doing on time?
We have to, basically to round up. Last question, please. Okay, Kirill.
Hi, my name is Kirill. Thank you for the talk. My question is about contradictions, because one of the most repetitive words is contradictions. And if you could talk a little bit about modern Russia, I work for a company called KPMG. It's a big consulting company, and I was surrounded by women, managers, senior managers, partners. Yes, most of them were men. And I've just checked a few reports, for example, Global Gender Gap Report by the World Economic Forum, 2019. The share of women and managers and senior government officials in Russia is 49.8% at that time, one of the highest in the world. And, there are different reports basically about women who hold senior managers position in businesses. And you see the percentage is very high. It's much higher than in America, yes. But at the same time, it's a patriarchal society. How can, well, so could you reflect on that? How does it coincide?
I don't know, Russia. It's the land of contradictions. I think, look, again, it's not surprising to me that women, that there were so many women at KPMG. Again, women are trusted with finances, they're trusted with accounting in a way that men aren't. And in fact, one of the things that women most frequently go to prison for in Russia, and we get into this in the book, are financial crimes, because they're usually the signing, the accountant who signs all the documents. And when there's a turf war between businesses, it's the accountant who's, it's the person whose signature is on the documents who gets thrown under the bus. So in these wars where criminal cases are open so that you can take over somebody's company, it's the woman accountant or CFO or whatever who gets sent to jail.
Just to clarify, I wasn't in the accounting department. Other departments also had a lot of women.
No,
That's the,
I understand, but there were also like lots of media managers who were women. But like you said, but at the partner, there were most doctors were women in the Soviet Union, and I think still are in Russia, but they're not at the decision making level. They're not at, like you said, they're not at the partner level. There's a very clear ceiling. And more is asked of them and less is given to them. I think these contradictions exist anywhere where women are asked to work full time and are asked to be, traditional women full time. How does that, I don't know, but Russian women managed to do it. But again, there's like when you see meetings of the Совет Безопасности, you see a lot of female faces there.
Bianca?
Do you see a lot of women?
No,
Do you see
one
49?
place.
Do you see 49.8% there?
I don't
No.
know.
So they, again, there's a very clear ceiling. And I think
I
that's.
think at that point, we have to thank Yulia Yoffe for this brilliant presentation. And now, I hope you will have time to send it.
Thank you.
Okay, so